Welcome to the Three Martini Lunch. Grab a stool next to Greg Corumbus of Radio America and Jim Garrity of National Review. Three Martini's coming up.
Hey, really glad you're with us for the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. We again have two good martinis for you today. Good. And really not good for the last one, and we'll get to that in just a moment. First, a couple of housekeeping items. First of all, we are heading into Memorial Day weekend. As a result, Monday will be a special edition of the Three Martini Lunch. If you heard our special last year and you loved it, you'll get to hear it again as Jim and I talk about what Memorial Day means to us and ought to mean to our country. And then we'll also give you the origin story to the Three Martini Lunch as a podcast, and also how Jim and I both became conservatives long, long ago. So please be sure to join us for that. Also, it was so popular last year, we're going to do it again. We are going to have special episodes coming up answering your questions. Could be anything. Could be fun. Could be personal. Could be political. We'll get a reaction to some political idea you have that we haven't addressed on the podcast. Get creative. Get your questions in. You can send them to me through direct message on my Twitter, @Dateline_DC. So, Jim, we never know what we're going to get, but if they're anything close to what we got last year, these are going to be really good questions.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. You want to do Jets and Bears questions, Aaron Rodgers, we'll talk about that. You want to talk 2024, we'll do our best to, you know, give a sense of what's, you know, to come, recognizing that we don't have a crystal ball. You want to talk 24 instead of 2024. We'll talk about that too.
Yes. Yeah. Versatile. Nothing if not versatile. So, all right. Well, let's get to our first good martini today. And Jim, the surprises here just keep piling up with the debt ceiling negotiations. And we should point out that according to Janet Yellen anyway, there's some dispute on the right about June 1st being this first date to potentially default. But nonetheless, as we get closer, we're not really sure what the outcome's going to be. But a lot of people, right, left, and center, seem to be agreeing that the Republicans are playing their hand much better than normal. And that includes the messaging game. In fact, even MSNBC was pointing out to a Biden spokesman yesterday, you know, Kevin McCarthy's on TV several times a day giving updates about where things stand and what his perspective is on this. And maybe hearing from the president once a week. But it's not just Biden himself. It's the fact that the Republicans are on message with this issue of we've got to be more responsible with our spending. And they are also doing well in rapid response. For example, there was this clip from House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries yesterday saying it's a total lie, total false narrative that the Democrats aren't willing to negotiate.
And these Republicans, they're going to say that Joe Biden refused to sit down with them. That's a fake narrative that they've continued to try to put into the public domain. They said that President Biden refused to talk for 97 days. Fake, false, fraudulent narrative.
Almost immediately, the Republicans were out with a long montage of Karine Jean-Pierre saying, not going to negotiate, not going to negotiate. I'm not going to play the whole thing. Here's just some of it.
The president's stance on negotiation stands, right? Which is he does not believe, as it relates to the debt ceiling, that we should be negotiating. We've been very clear. We're not going to negotiate on the debt ceiling.
He never came to the table to negotiate on the debt ceiling. That was not something that occurred. That is not something that's happening. We've been very clear. We're not negotiating around the debt ceiling. When you think about the debt limit, it is not negotiable. We should not be negotiating on the debt ceiling.
And so, Jim, you know, as I said at the very top, it's not just conservatives who think that the House Republicans are doing well here. Washington Post, Punch Bowl, NBC, Politico, pretty much across the board, Republicans are seen as winning the messaging war. Now, how that translates in the end, I don't know, but they've got their game together much better than normal.
Greg, I think we're watching something significant happen here, and you can see it manifesting in like three different components. The first is the polling numbers. As mentioned, the Fox News poll saying that Biden would be slightly more blamed than House Republicans if there's a default. The polling numbers indicate that a solid majority of the public supports work requirements for certain federal benefits, that the solid majority, including nearly half of Democrats, believe there should be spending cuts if they're going to raise the debt ceiling. So the Democrats have kind of backed themselves into a position that the public is not on their side, and their entire messaging is about how extreme and outlandish and out of beyond the pale the Republican position is. But the polling does not bear that out at all. Second one is that the polling numbers, that clearly there's such a big difference here that institutions like NBC News are looking at this and saying, yes, Republicans are winning the messaging war. And that's not what they are naturally inclined to say. That's not what they got up every morning and really are itching to tell people. If they're saying it, it's kind of an admission against interest. So we know what's really going on there. And it's, my suspicion is that this is kind of like, it's like a warning sign to Democrats. Hey, Democrats, you're losing this fight. In fact, you have lost this fight to this point. And then the third aspect of this, as you mentioned, you see it in just about everybody who's covering the debt ceiling negotiations. Politico, NBC News, Washington Post, Punch Bowl. Every one of them has some version of a story where they talk to House Democrats and House Democrats say, I have no idea what we're doing. There's no messaging from the White House. There's no coordination with the White House. Biden and his team aren't telling us what they're willing to what they're willing to concede on and where they're going to, you know, draw their red lines. They're not quoting on the record, but you're getting comments like, quote, it's time to bring the president off the bench or bring somebody off the bench. Nobody's responding to anything. Kevin, meaning Kevin McCarthy, is frequently on message. We have the Oval Office. I've never seen anything like it. Lots of other similar comments like that. Now, the bulwark, which I don't want to get into a habit of mentioning on this podcast, but Charlie Sykes said a column today, like, where's the bully pulpit? Why isn't Biden going out there and using the bully pulpit to win this fight? Well, I think the fact that he's not using the bully pulpit to win this fight is a demonstration that Biden is not capable of using the bully pulpit to win this fight. And as I somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but not entirely, said, you know, the fact that he's not going out and doing the, you know, using the bully pulpit the way you'd like probably has something to do with the fact that he's 80 years old, that Biden mumbles and meanders and his, you know, his thoughts kind of drift off whenever he's not reading from a teleprompter. He only does public events between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. on weekdays. He doesn't do stuff on the weekends. He doesn't do a lot of late night events. And he spends almost every weekend in Delaware. We are 7 days away from default. The president is scheduled to go to Camp David this weekend. Now, obviously, he can keep negotiating while he's at Camp David. I think we all know the president is himself doesn't really do any of the lead negotiations on this. And it's all up to the staff, and we'll see what happens between now and then. But before you say, you know, bully pulpit, Greg, I know you, I just have this Jim Mora voice in my head. Bully pulpit? Bully pulpit? You're hoping Biden can get through a speech sometime around lunchtime every day. He's not going to go out there and barnstorm the country. He gets tired for 3 days when he goes over to Ireland. This is not a guy who's going to run around using the bully pulpit. So, you know, there are a lot of ramifications for this. Like, this is, you know, middle of 2023. Biden's probably not going to be that much more energetic or fired up or any, you know, better 6 months from now or a year from now or in the autumn of 2024. What you see with Biden is what you get, and it's only downhill from here. So, you know, what I'm now working on, this is one of the reasons you listen to this podcast, sometimes you get to hear about my corner posts before I write them, is just kind of observing, like, this is, there's no reason for Democrats to think that Joe Biden is going to be a better person, a more effective speaker, a more effective communicator, a better, you know, architect of the bully pulpit a year from now than he is then. And that should make them very nervous about 2024. But between now and then, we've got a debt-ceiling fight to resolve, which, oh, by the way, it certainly looks like Republicans are winning.
Yeah, a few thoughts on all this. First of all, it's a little curious that the principled conservative, quote-unquote, position is that the president needs to do more to make sure that we don't have any spending restraints. Mm. But anyway, the other thing, there was another quote yesterday from an anonymous House Democrat who was just flabbergasted that Biden was leaving town this weekend with this supposedly dire deadline just a few days away. But he remained anonymous because he didn't want to be criticized by the White House for going on the record with that. And also CNN yesterday, perhaps in consistent format with the other polls we've seen just on the debt ceiling, 66% of Americans right now think that another Biden term would be either a setback or a disaster for the country. Two-thirds. If we can't beat that, we've got big problems. And we might not beat that.
That still means there's a third that likes me.
Yeah, and yesterday he had a debt ceiling statement in the Rose Garden. He was wearing the sunglasses. You could tell he was just staring down the prompter. There wasn't a lot going on other than just kind of rote recitation. But the Republicans are in a good spot in a lot of different ways here. So hopefully they can make the most of it. All right, Jim, let's move to our second good martini. And at a time when every person with an R next to their name announces they're running for something, including the governor of North Dakota deciding he's going to run for president, Doug Burgum. Sure, that was a household name until today. We also have one Republican who has decided not to run next year in a critical U.S. Senate race. And that's Doug Mastriano, the state representative in Pennsylvania. He was the GOP nominee for governor there last year, lost by a wide margin, about 15 points, Democrat Josh Shapiro. He was seriously talking about running for Senate against Bob Casey Jr., who is going for a fourth term. Going to be a tough race no matter what. But Doug Mastriano now says he is not going to run for Senate next year. And based on the reporting that I've seen, this was not exactly an unpressured decision, Jim. He had a state representative named Russ Diamond write an op-ed on May 24th saying, "Your appearance at the top of the Republican ticket last year undoubtedly contributed to Republicans losing the majority in the Pennsylvania House. And I fear a repeat of that in 2024, as nothing in the state has changed to mitigate that impact." Perhaps more significantly, allegedly Donald Trump has encouraged him not to get in this race because he thinks Mastriano could be potentially a drag on his own ambitions, assuming he's the Republican nominee. So, Jim, sometimes it takes a little bit of a slap in the face to wake you up, but I think this is the smart move for Mastriano and Republicans in general.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm glad that you gave us the breaking news that North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum wants to run for president. Readers, I have two other hot breaking updates to this. It turns out that Doug Burgum is the governor of North Dakota. A lot of people did not know that. And the second thing, which is even less known here, particularly here on the East Coast, North Dakota is a state. It is one of 50 of them. It is above South Dakota and next to Minnesota. Regarding Doug Mastriano, I am breaking out the party hats. And I had kind of, when I saw the news this morning, I was like, what happened here and how can we replicate it for a whole bunch of candidates who ran in 2022 and who are insistent upon running again in 2024 on basically the same message and the same approach, same strategy, same way of doing things. I'm not, as we, you and I have discussed in this podcast a couple of times, I'm not automatically vehemently opposed to somebody running a second time. I just want you, if you've not succeeded the first time, tell me what you're going to do different. Have a plan to do things differently. Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who really have this idea that, you know, instead of saying I didn't do enough on Get Out the Vote, or my ads were weak, or I had a lousy debate performance or something like that, they blame everybody except themselves. And they're basically saying, well, this time the voters will just fall in love with me. They'll realize what a terrible mistake they made by not voting for me last time, and they'll beg me for forgiveness. And I'll be swept into office because now the electorate sees how charming and wonderful I am. Nope, sorry, the world very rarely works that way. It's possible the person who beat you last time will be seen as such a disaster. And I guess if you have a close enough swing district, maybe that can work it that way, but I wouldn't count on it. J.R. Majewski's running again. Joe Kent is running again. And of course, in Arizona, there have been rumors for both Blake Masters and Kari Lake running for Senate. Masters, it seems like the buzz around him has died down. Lake, the buzz has definitely increased. And look, if op-eds are what it takes from other, you know, state lawmakers, you know, saying you running are hurting the party, you did not succeed last time, you are giving us no indication you're going to do anything different this time, you are going to be a drag on Republicans who actually have a chance to win their races, stay out and don't come back until you have something new and different and have a better plan to win, you know, if that's what it takes, then let's get those op-eds running. I think what you alluded to there, the fact that Trump was not enthusiastic, was probably decisive. And who knows? The interesting question is, you know, does Trump see Kari Lake as someone who makes him more likely to win Arizona or less likely to win Arizona? Oh, by the way, getting Trump to 270 electoral votes without Arizona is tough. Not impossible, but he'd have to, you know, win Pennsylvania, win Georgia, and make up some of those electoral votes somewhere else. So the other thing you periodically hear about is that apparently Trump is a huge fan of Kari Lake. Kari Lake is a huge fan of Trump. And I keep hearing people saying, oh, you know, she's a strong contender to be his running mate in 2024 if he's the GOP nominee. I don't know if that's going to happen. Trump has, you know, made comments indicating he would like to have a woman as a running mate. A lot of Trump advisors say that's extremely likely. So you certainly couldn't rule that out. And if they really do have such a mutual admiration society, it certainly seems like that could be a case that could come out there. So maybe this will be a moot because she'll be on the, you know, vice presidential slot in the GOP ticket in 2024. But, you know, at some point, these candidates who did not succeed need to show that they have some way to win other than, oh, it's a presidential year. Trump will bring people turn out. Okay. But you know what? If Trump's going to bring people out, why do we nominate you for? What are you going to do? What do you bring to the table? if you're just a remora eel, what's the way they, you know, attach to the bottom of the shark and try to, you know, swim along? If you can't bring any strength to the table, what does the party need you for? So for now, good for you, Doug Mastriano. I did not expect to be saying that. I'm glad that you're not running. Look, I can't guarantee Dave McCormick would have beaten Fetterman. You can imagine a scenario where Democrats beat him up because of his, you know, running the world's largest hedge fund and stuff like that. But I've talked to a bunch of Republicans who look at it and say, yeah, McCormick would have won. Mehmet Oz was a wet, you know, wet squib of a candidate. I don't know if it's necessarily fair. Oz did get better as time went on, but it'd be nice to see McCormick versus Casey and see that contrast, see how much, if there's any, if McCormick runs significantly better than Oz did. So we'll see, Greg, but that does strike me as a move in the right direction.
Jim, I am not a professional campaign consultant, but here is my expert advice. Nominate someone who lives in Pennsylvania. I think, a prerequisite to this situation. But yeah, and it's hard, you know, you've got ambitions. Everybody who's in politics always wonders if they can go one rung higher on the ladder. But some of these people, you just look at the electorate and how they're campaigning, and it's just not going to happen. It's, you know, I hate to use the example because Rocky ended up winning the fight, but in Rocky IV, when his wife is screaming at him down the stairs going, "You can't win." And so ultimately he does. But a lot of these situations, you're just looking at the climate that they're running in and what they're doing, and you're just like, you have no chance. You have absolutely no chance. So we'll see who emerges there. A long, long way to go. North Dakota, we do love you. We just don't see how a guy that, like Doug Burgum, who I don't think has any national profile, he may be great. Maybe doing a great job in North Dakota. I hope he is. I've heard that he's doing a pretty good job pushing back against the administration's energy policies and so forth. But I think you've got to be a little bit better known to try to make a serious run. But who knows? The bigger issue here is that this field's getting crowded pretty quickly. So, Jim, I regret a couple months ago saying, I think the field's pretty much closed now, don't you?
Yeah, and I'll observe, like, every now and then you look at these surveys. If I remember correctly, Burgum's been very popular during his tenure in North Dakota. And there was a part of me that's thought, you know, maybe what, you know, the Republicans need after having a whole bunch of series of disappointing cycles is to have some governor who comes in with a relatively unknown to the rest of the country, sort of a fresh start, clean slate kind of candidate, who's accumulated a very strong record in some state that basically the national media has ignored, and that they can point to and say, hey, look at what I've done in this state. Wouldn't this be good for the rest of the country? A version of what, you know, Ron DeSantis is trying to do on the Florida scale, except, you know, Florida's gotten a hell of a lot of scrutiny over the last couple of years, particularly since the beginning of the pandemic, and much less scrutiny to a place like North Dakota. In theory, you know, a lesser known governor could be an appealing option. I just don't think this is the cycle to do it. I think, you know, we've seen, if Nikki Haley is having a hard time getting traction, and Tim Scott and everybody else, it's really hard to see a scenario where Burgum, you know, catches fire and suddenly is, you know, the next big thing in American politics. And maybe that's unfair, but that's the state of the world. And I don't know if there's, you know, any point in jumping in and elbowing out Asa Hutchinson to say, hey, or Larry Elder and say, hey, I'm the guy who's going to be, who really shakes up the 2024 race.
Yeah, I would really like the debates to be held at once. I don't want two debates like we had in 2016. Everybody should be able to fit on one stage. And if you're on the margins, it's probably not your time. But anyway, I hope he's doing a fantastic job for the good people in North Dakota. All right, on to our final martini, Jim, both bad and crazy, I would say. And we've talked about AI in the future. This is certainly not an area where I am on the cutting edge. You know it better. I think you've said your kids know it even better than you do. But there is, I guess, one of the more reasonable Democrats in Congress who feels like the Pentagon is not taking the AI threat seriously in terms of how other more hostile nations could use it in terms of their militaries, including one day, not as far in the future as a lot of people might think, where they could have actual non-human soldiers. That's Seth Moulton, Massachusetts. He's a decorated veteran of the war on terrorism. According to this Politico story, he says that they could replace actual soldiers on the battlefield, and he says that the Defense Department has not done much of anything to address concerns about the role artificial intelligence could play in the military down the line. He told the Digital Future Daily in an interview following his op-ed in the Boston Globe on Wednesday, warning of the imminent danger that this tech poses to humanity. He likened the threat to nuclear weapons and warned the United States has been ceding ground to foreign rivals. And from his vantage point on the House Armed Services Committee and as a top Democrat on military matters, the Pentagon needs to be doing more now. So, Jim, staying at the cutting edge on all this stuff, the cyber wars that we always seem to be trying to stay on top of, China and Russia and everybody else, and now this 21st century technology is going to another level, and it seems like somebody who has all the incentive in the world to be praiseworthy of this administration at the Defense Department, definitely not.
So, as I discuss more in a forthcoming big piece in National Review, might even be on the cover, I am the father of two teenagers. So first, thank you for your prayers. Second of all, as I've mentioned, my older teenager knows a lot about this stuff and is constantly telling me, Dad, it is not like the Terminator movies. All of your James Cameron is not an actual expert in AI. They are not documentaries. You cannot use that as your basis for understanding. And by and large, the only way an AI will turn evil and try to destroy humanity is if you type in parameters, if X, then turn evil and destroy humanity. That there is no way it will spontaneously decide to do these things. Now, again, I cannot base all of humanity on the assessment of a teenager who I think is, you know, the brightest and most wonderful child anybody could ever want. But that, you know, there are people in this world who know more than I do. Having said that, there are a lot of people older than my teenager who are professionals who look at this stuff who are getting freaked out, including the guy who was nicknamed the Godfather of AI, who did a big interview and various like kind of professional groups that work with AI are kind of recognizing this stuff is developing exponentially fast. It's growing faster. And we kind of, it's experiments. So you don't really know what it's going to be able to do. A couple of weeks ago, I guess it was less than a week ago, but life comes at you fast. I wrote about a story in the South China Morning Post about China's experiments in artificial intelligence. And I recognize that, you know, anything that we're hearing from the Chinese government is something that they want us to know. But this story did say that, in fact, they'd given an artificial intelligence program control over an Earth observation satellite, and it just decided to start looking at two militarily significant spots. One was Patna, which is in northeast India, which is home to the Bihar Regiment, an Indian army unit that had already fought with China's military back in 2020, and also Osaka, which is a busy port that occasionally hosts U.S. Navy vessels. Now, the AI just spontaneously started looking at those places. I don't know what that means. I don't know whether it means it's targets or whether it's something that it wants to know more about. But it was very interesting. They kind of determined those two spots were significant. At least this is what we're hearing from the journal Geomatics and Information Science of Wuhan University. Yes, the same Wuhan. That's the home of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Look, hasn't Wuhan given the world enough joys and pleasures and, you know, amazing things? And it's not just the idea of, oh, somebody's going to deliberately develop, you know, kill bots or some sort of artificial intelligence that has the authority to kill people and do terrible things. There's also the nagging fear of something accidental, of, you know, somebody not intending to create something that is harmful and malicious and capable of great danger, but they managed to do it along the way. There is a fierce debate going on about whether the U.S. should enact some sort of restrictions on AI research. I'm not going to pretend that I know I have all the answers. I can see those of us who've watched Terminator and think, oh, well, this is how the world ends. You give an AI control of the U.S. nuclear arsenal and it starts blowing things up because it wants to be free of humanity. We have all these cautionary tales of technology developing outside beyond the human capacity to control them. And the question of whether humanity is mature enough and whether humanity is wise enough to have weapons like this. There's a movie coming out this summer about Oppenheimer, who grappled with this question, right? You know, once humanity has the ability to split the atom and create a bomb of such enormous power, are we going to reach a point where we destroy ourselves? These are real big, heavy, serious questions. And, you know, I'll understand if people come to different conclusions about this, but it does seem like big questions we should be thinking about. And the really frightening thing is, let's say the United States says, yes, this stuff is too dangerous. We cannot keep this stuff under control. We're not going to do this kind of research. Do we end up in the same mess if the Chinese continue to do this kind of research? or the Russians or Europeans or any other, you know, group on Earth? Does somebody open up Pandora's box? Does somebody end up creating something that we can't control and that can end up causing, you know, chaos for lots of people? Giant questions. Don't have to pretend to know. Seth Moulton's nervousness is a bad sign because I get the feeling he's not, you know, admission against interest. He's not looking to tear the, you know, the Biden administration or Pentagon apart. Should make us sit up and take notice. Hey, happy Memorial Day weekend, everybody.
Jim Garrity, National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for being with us today. Thanks for subscribing to the podcast. If you haven't already, please do that. Tell some friends about us as well. Also, thank you for your 5-star ratings and your kind reviews. Please keep those coming. Also, get us on your home devices. All you have to say is play 3 Martini Lunch Podcast. Also, follow us on Twitter. He's at Jim Garrity. I'm at Dateline_DC. And that's where you can direct message me to get your questions in for those upcoming future episodes. Also, remember our special Memorial Day episode coming up on Monday. We'll be back with our usual format on Tuesday. Until then, have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. And please take the time to honor those who have given the last full measure of devotion to our country and to all those who have worn the uniform and their families. Have a great weekend, everyone.